Hi, everybody. Welcome to Spill the OT Podcast, episode 17. I cannot believe that we have done 17 episodes. This is crazy. So today we're going to switch things up a little bit. As you know, all of our podcasts have so far been focused on a different setting. So we've done like OT in a skilled nursing facility, OT in a outpatient clinic, OT as a DOR, those types of things. I still want to continue to do that. So if you are an OT and you're in a field that we haven't covered yet, so something like home health or lymphedema or a certified hand therapist, or if you're in some sort of specialty that you think would be cool for us to talk about, I would love to have you come on. But for the time being, I want to switch gears a little bit and focus on different diagnoses. Of course, these are just generalizations. It's so hard to cover a specific diagnosis because it's so broad. But I thought that we would start off with autism because that's a pretty common one. And I've had a lot of people who work in the geriatric population or just with adults in general who want to get into the school systems. And they're like, I don't know how to get going because I'm kind of scared of kids and I don't know how to talk to kids. And I don't want the kids to bite me. And they just don't have the experience maybe with kids in general, and specifically don't have the experience with kids who are on the spectrum or require some additional special needs. So I think that it would be cool to just go over what different diagnoses, and it's not limited to the schools. Obviously, that's, you know, where my brain goes to. So we're starting off with autism. ADHD will be next week. But I would love to interview other people as well who maybe someone could talk about stroke, muscular dystrophy, MS, Parkinson's. We could even do like one on a total hip replacement or a total knee replacement. So I just thought it'd be cool if we could do a different diagnosis as well as the different settings. And I'm totally open. I'm really leaving it a lot up to you guys to who writes in and who wants to be our expert, quote unquote. You don't actually have to be an expert. I just want you to share your experiences. And then if you're listening and you're like, whoa, I work with someone with autism and it's nothing like this, then please come on and just share what you've found and what you've experienced, because, you know, everybody in every setting is so crazy different and we just can all learn from each other. Let's get our guest on the line. And this interview is awesome. It's a little bit on the longer side, so I'm going to try and jump into it right away. But she just had so much great content to share. I just loved hearing all her treatment ideas. I was even like picking up ideas for myself because she just has so much to offer. So let's get her on the line.
I always babysat throughout my whole life. And when I was in my undergrad at NYU, I thought I wanted to become a French teacher. And so I was babysitting and starting to look at some different opportunities. And I saw a student that I could babysit for with autism. And he was, I want to say, around 6 at the time. And so I went for the interview not having any experience with autism at all, but really curious about it and just wanting to stretch myself a little bit to see what I could do and what, you know, what working with a student or a child with disabilities would be like. And I absolutely fell in love with the experience. He had an OT come into the home and work with him, and I thought it was just amazing. I took him to a lot of different therapies, but to see the OT in action, it was really cool because she was playing with him and doing things with him that he loved, but it was therapy. And so that's really what got me actually into the OT field, was working with a student or a child with autism. And so that was really, really cool. So then I ended up switching my major to applied psychology and then starting to shift my focus into trying to get as many opportunities as possible to work with kids and adults on the spectrum. So like I said, I was at NYU. So in Manhattan, there's a school called the Rebecca School. And so when I was there, I started volunteering there on Fridays. And again, working with students with neurodevelopmental disabilities, so a lot of autism, a lot of like fragile X and things like that. And so I, again, love my experience. And that made me apply to graduate school. So I have my master's of science in occupational therapy from Tufts University. I knew I wanted to do schools. I knew I wanted to do peds from the beginning. I knew I loved kids. But I definitely wanted to stretch myself and make sure that I was a well-rounded practitioner. They really emphasized that. So I did get a school-based case practice certificate while I was at Tufts, so that it gave me just a lot more experience understanding IDEA and ADA and all the different models that we use in the school, so that I could feel really confident. But I did my field work, I did two different ones. So in Tufts, I was studying outside of Massachusetts, but I came back home where I'm from Michigan, for field work. And my first one was at an inpatient rehab hospital. So no autism, no kids, strokes, Parkinson's, debility, just those kind of diagnoses. So I tried to stretch myself and become a well-rounded practitioner. And then my second one was in a school-based setting. And so from there, it really, again, verified for me that I want to work with kids. It did help me learn a lot about neuro and that kind of stuff, which I take into my practice now. But so from there, I did, for my first one was the inpatient rehab hospital. So the second one was the schools. And from there, I started looking for school positions. I wanted a direct hire position. So it took me about a year before I got into my current position. So while I was waiting, I took a job at an outpatient pediatric facility at a local hospital, which has been really rewarding. I continue to work there as well during the school year on Monday evenings, as well as during the whole summer. And so both are really, really nice avenues, all pediatrics, but I get to do a little bit of both. But I've been in my school position. This is my third year. I'm a direct hire position, which I think is really, really great. I'm a part of the staff in each building that I'm in. I attend their staff meetings. I'm a real voice in the setting, which is really nice. And then I also do some private practice as well, just outside of that.
Pardon my ignorance, but does direct hire just mean that you're hired through the school, not as a contract?
Exactly, yep. And so some of the benefits of that are, like if there's snow days in Michigan, we get some snow. And so if you're contracted through that, you don't get paid on those days, on those holidays. And so that's really nice. I am part of the union, which is really beneficial for me too. Every time the whole district gets pay raises, I'm included in that, which is, it gives me a little bit more security for the future as well.
Oh yeah, that's great. Yeah. Now I know I didn't ask you this ahead of time, so feel free to say no, but a lot of what my podcast is I talk about the financial piece.
Yeah.
So would you feel comfortable giving like a ballpark of what you make as an OT in the school system?
Yeah. So So again, this is something that I wasn't really clear about before I went to school. I like had Googled, oh, what does an OT make? And I was like super pumped because I was seeing start out at 80 grand a year. And I was like, well, that's great. That's awesome. But it's definitely a lot lower than that. So pediatrics is definitely one of the lower income areas. And so that definitely impacts my overall salary. But like I said, it's nice to be in the schools because I can really forecast what I'm going to be getting paid in the future. And I also am a part of that loan forgiveness program because I work for the school setting. So that's also, an incentive for me, but about $50,000 a year is where I'm at with the schools.
I'm so glad you said that because that's exactly what I did. And I was like, awesome. I'm going to get out of school and make all this money and pay off all my debt. And it just isn't the case. You have to be really, really strategic in order to even come close to that amount.
Right. And that was what my big wake up call too was. I was like, oh, so that people who work with older adults are making that kind of money. And I'm like, that is not where I want to be. I love kids. And the last thing I want to do is work with older adults. That's just not, people who do it are great, but I'm just not that kind of person.
Yeah. And even still then, I don't want to get too off topic, but then you're focused on productivity. So they might say you'll make $75,000 a year, but if the census is low, then you might get cut at 4 hours a day, which is going to cut your salary in half. So I work in a school as well, and I really like the security, and we are in the union too. So it just really gives a lot of that job security. And I know you make a lot less, but I feel like knowing what you're going to be paid for the next year and being able to plan is a good sense of relief.
Yeah, for sure. And like I was saying too, the benefit of really being a part of the team. I've worked in other places where you just don't feel like you're just kind of, you're in and you're out as the OT. And that's not what I wanted. I wanted teachers to be able to come to me with their concerns and not feel like, oh, you're not a real member of this group. You just come in and see your kids and you leave. I wanted them to feel like I'm a real part of that community.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So let's change gears and start talking about autism. Mm-hmm. Can you start us off by just saying how a lot of these students present for OT? I know mm-hmm. that that's a huge spectrum, but just in general.
Yeah, so like you said, it is a big spectrum. And it's something that people are just becoming so much more aware of nowadays. So I feel like before you might have mentioned autism to someone and they might have not really known what it was, or they might have thought they knew what it was based off of, you know, the media, but they didn't really have a full picture of what a person on the spectrum can really look like. And so some of the things that I kind of look for if I'm going to try to identify someone that's on the spectrum, not trying to diagnose them, but if I'm out in the community and I see someone, some of the things that I typically see are some kind of self-stimulatory behavior. So that's one of the big ones that can kind of set a person on the spectrum apart, is you might see some of that hand flapping or the vocal stims. They might be doing some repetitive language, some of the echolalia, that kind of thing. That's something that can kind of zero you in on someone on the spectrum, but not all of my students do that. And I know some students that do some of that self-stimulatory behavior that are not on the spectrum. So it definitely doesn't mean automatic, you know, if someone is self-stimming that they're on the spectrum, but it's definitely something that you might see more often. So this year I work in an elementary program for kids on the spectrum, and a lot of the kids in there, like the preferred interests, I think is the one thing that really kind of sets them apart. All kids have an interest, but with kids on the spectrum, what I tend to see is like a very narrowed in specific preferred interest, a preferred topic that, you know, like it's almost like an obsessive kind of nature where they love that topic. That's one of the things that I always use to get in with a kid like that, as I always, you know, before I start working with them, I want to know, okay, like what is their thing? Like what makes them tick? What's their favorite thing? So like one of my kids right now, he's obsessed with superheroes, but it has to be the DC kind. So that was like a big thing, right? So I, you know, in my head, I'm like, oh yeah, I know superheroes. I know, you know, I watch the Marvel movies. And he like automatically was like, I was like judged by him. Like, no, Marvel's not cool. DC is cool. And so that's one of the things I think, like I've worked with one little boy who is just in love with the number 6 train in New York City. Like the subway, the number 6 train was his most favorite thing. Some other kids, their most favorite thing might be Fortnite, even though that's like a popular thing right now, it becomes to a level that is like what makes them tick. That's what makes their world go round.
And when you say that you first start working with someone, do you kind of encourage them to talk about these things? But then at what point do you kind of turn it off and try and have them focus on more broad topics?
Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the things that like before, so stepping back a little bit. So when I was first kind of doing that, like exploratory, like, I love autism. Is this what I want to do? I volunteered at an ABA facility for a little bit, and then they offered me a position for a summer. And so I did that kind of model for a little bit. And then at that Rebecca school I was talking about, it was a floor time model, which they're very different on the spectrum. So like ABA is a very like scientific behavioralist model. And that's one of the big treatments that a lot of people with autism go to. That's what insurance covers. That's like one of the number one things that doctors kind of recommend when they provide that diagnosis. But it really teaches to use those preferred interests as a reward, right? And so if like, you know, like my little friend who loves superheroes, we would work, and he wouldn't be allowed to talk about any superheroes. But then after his work was done, he could have like 2 minutes where he could watch a show about them, or we could talk about them. The floor time model is different in that we use that preferred interest to engage and to promote a relationship. And that's the big push for that model. So I tend to use a little bit of both. So I don't necessarily try to get them to switch unless I'm working on some kind of like social skill development, where I'll kind of act like a peer and kind of say, you know, like, I'm really not into that. Is there anything else we can talk about, right? So I can kind of foster and practice with them some social skills. But I tend to really try to use those interests to help me get my students to participate in therapy. So like I was saying before, how I loved how that first therapist was playing with the kid I was babysitting for. I loved that he didn't know it was therapy. And so that's something I try to embody. So for example, one of my students, this one who really loves the superheroes, we were really struggling. He was just having a really off day, and I really wasn't able to connect with him and get him to participate. And so he was at that point where he's like, I'm not like sitting at the table, like I'm not doing anything with you. And I was like, okay, like that's cool. Today's not going to be the way that I planned it out to be. I think that's one of the biggest things as an OT is you really have to be super flexible and let sometimes your plans go aside. And so that's what I did. And I said, oh man, like are any movies coming out soon that you're really excited about? Because I knew before that I know that there's always a superhero movie coming, right? And so he was super excited about the Shazam movie that was coming. So this was a few weeks ago. And I said, oh man, that's super cool. Like, do you know when it's coming out? And he's like, no, I don't remember what day. And so let's look it up. And so we looked it up on, I think I used Siri to be honest. And we like just practiced that. And we looked it up. And I said, oh man, like, where's your calendar? We should totally put this in your calendar. And so I had a handwriting goal for him. And I was able to get him to start writing with me because we looked it up in his calendar, which is a life skill, right? To be able to look in your calendar and be able to put something in. And so we did that. And he wrote down in his calendar, the Shazam movie's premiering, right? And so that was one. And I said, well, what other movies are there? And so we were able to use that preferred interest to engage in therapy without him feeling like the pressure of, oh, I have to do this before we're allowed to do this. And we ended up turning it into a really nice session, but he didn't know that I was trying to like trick him or persuade him into interacting with me.
That's amazing. That sounds like such an ideal session that you're able to spin it that way. I see a lot of the ABA where I work. I'm in agreement with you. I don't want to get too controversial.
Yeah.
But, you know, in life, it's hard to compartmentalize different areas, especially if it's kind of this overwhelming interest. So the fact that you're able to kind of blend it and have him not even realize that he's doing therapy is really amazing. And he did probably whatever you would have wanted him to do at some point in your session anyway.
Hey everybody, I am so genuinely excited to tell you about MedBridge. So MedBridge is a continuing ed site and they have tons of continuing ed courses all available online. You can stream them at your own pace. They also have home exercise plans, which are incredible. You can literally build your own plan with pictures that can perfectly suit whatever client you're working for. It's honestly so awesome. And you get unlimited CEUs. And these CEU courses are just really intriguing and exciting. Like I've done continuing ed online in the past, and these ones that they select are just very much in line with what I find interesting, and I feel like you might find them interesting as well. So, are you struggling with finding the resources for your time for CEUs? With almost 2,000 accredited evidence-based streaming courses, live CEU webinars, MedBridge is your all-in-one solution. And actually, if you use my code, it's SPILLTHEOT, capital S, capital T, capital OT. So SPILLTHEOT, one word, capital S, capital T, capital OT. You can get $175 off of your year-long subscription, which is awesome. I mean, that's like significant amount of money off. So if you are interested, please go check it out. Again, use the code SPILLTHEOT, capital S, capital T, capital OT, all one word. All right. I really hope that you go check it out. Enjoy.
Right. Exactly. And like you said, though, I think I use a mix of both. So I think that like, I'm totally into rewards. Like I work for a paycheck, right? Like I do things for rewards. We all do. And so I think that I like to embody both of them. So at the end of my sessions, yes, my kids get to do something fun. But I like to be a part of the fun. I think that's the big thing because especially with kids on the spectrum, those social relationships are really hard to navigate. And so if I can make them see like this is a practice like social situation, right? And we get to practice having fun together and seeing how much fun it is to interact with someone else and how sometimes you have to be flexible with the way you approach things. Sometimes we might not be able to do exactly what you want to do, but at the end of the day, we're both having fun.
That's awesome. Can you share what types of delays that you see most that impact their academics?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of my kids on the spectrum, fine motor is a really tricky, tricky thing for them. So it ends up looking like really poor legibility with handwriting. So in the schools, we're always looking at disabilities or the way that they impact the school setting or impact their school participation. So handwriting comes up, I would say, the most frequently for those kids, as well as sometimes even something as simple as being able to open up their lunchbox containers or things like that too, because of that weakness in their hands. And so I'm doing a lot of strengthening for those types of things. I'm teaching a lot of remediation skills for the handwriting, as well as using a lot of technology. A lot of times with my kids on the spectrum, I end up pushing technology a little bit earlier than I do with some of my other students, because the output is so much more important. And so sometimes I think people can get bogged down in, okay, like we have to make their writing exactly perfect. But if I'm getting output, that's what matters. So even if it's something where they're using like a Google Read and Write technology to be able to do like speech to text to participate, I feel like that's just as meaningful as them being able to write three sentences. And so that's something that I use quite a bit, just because the frustration is so high. And it's already a hard thing for them to be at school all day. And so if I can make that a little bit easier by providing that technology, I try to do that sooner than later.
Can you share what some of your IEP goals may look like?
So some of them are like very straightforward handwriting goals. So like that, you know, so-and-so would be able to demonstrate improved legibility as evidenced by, you know, correctly sizing this percentage of letters on a classroom sample. And then some of the ones that I do for like the technology might be that they would complete a classroom assignment using that technology with no more than a certain amount of prompts. And so it just really focuses again on the school, on the school-based goals. So really making sure we're taking into account that everything goes back to their curriculum. But then I also too, I started doing a zones of regulation group with that population as well. And so a lot of it is also like underground practice. That's what we referred to it as when I was in grad school. So it's not exactly like an IEP goal, but I'm working on their self-regulation, their emotional intelligence, their ability to cope with frustration as well. And so again, it's not like a IEP goal for them, but it's something that's like a personal goal that I'm working towards.
I love the zones of regulation. I feel like I've seen that across many districts. I think that's one of the best ones. Could you please share like how often these kids are getting therapy?
Mm-hmm. So the kids in like that kind of program that I'm working on, they are in what's like a gen ed setting, right? So they go into their gen ed classroom, but they are their resource room support teacher is like an autism certified teacher. And so these kids that I'm talking about right now, they're in elementary. So they're the ones that I have are first through fifth grade. And so I see them typically once a week for a half hour for like a session that's really targeting like those fine motor skills. But then every other week I do that zones group with them on top of that service frequency.
Okay. And are most of your students for they're on one-on-one sessions, you said?
Yes, typically. So it can be a little challenging with that group, with that population, just because they can be pretty competitive and I see a lot of shutdowns. So it's not that I'm in the resource room where I pull them. I try to push into the classroom too as much as possible, but unfortunately, some of those students really struggle with that environment. And so, you know, I always am trying to make it as conducive to their success as possible. So sometimes if it makes sense for me to be in their classroom, I go in there. But typically they're in the resource room with me with other students in there, but I'm working one-on-one with them. In the past, I've tried to do some dyads and things like that, but it became too competitive between the two students, despite me trying to squash it or negate any of that competitive nature or try to make it therapeutic. It just felt a little bit too negative. And so I moved more towards the one-on-ones.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
But in the zones group that I do, they are in a group of about 4 to 5 students. And so we do get to practice that socialization and dealing with conflict, but in just a different setting.
Could you think of a student in your head and then detail what you would do like step by step for one treatment session?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm thinking of one student right now in particular. And when he comes in to work with me, it's always on their schedule. They always have like a visual schedule that they start with during the day. That visual schedule I always recommend for people who are working with someone on the spectrum. It just can really make them feel a lot more comfortable when they know what's coming and what's going to be happening, especially, you know, if they want to go home, they get to see what's next, right? And so they get to see their whole day lined up, and they get to see as things get accomplished, they get to move them over. So I'm on his schedule, and he'll come up and work with me, and he usually comes a little bit early so he can bring a snack. So he'll start with doing a snack, and we usually start by doing some kind of fine motor exercise. So whether that's TheraPutty, whether that's pop beads, whether that's some kind of like origami activity, it's usually something more fun and something that's just really there to warm up their hands, to exercise them a little bit. I give lots of choices during my treatment, so I'll usually at least have a choice of two that he can pick for like a warm up for him. So let's say he picks the putty, he'll do the putty. And then the next thing we try to do is some kind of visual exercise or visual activity. And so whether that's a maze, whether that is something, like a crosswordy type of thing, whatever he's interested in that right now, or usually something holiday related, I'll have printed out for him to do. And then the last thing we always end up with is the handwriting. I'm using the Size Matters handwriting protocol or program with a lot of my students. I'm finding a lot of success. And so we'll do some kind of writing with that and end on that. At the end, like I said earlier, they're getting some kind of also like an immediate reward for their positive interaction, for their participation. So a lot of my students are on behavior plans. And so as they're going along, I'm giving them like circling different things for them, whether or not they're participating well, giving them full points. And at the end, we look at it together to see, do I think that they should get the reward or not? And whether that's some Roblox time, whether that's playing a certain game with me that they wanted to play. As the session goes, though, I am always trying to be really attentive to my student, right? And so that might mean if I'm starting to see my students start to get a little bit stressed out early on when we're first starting, that might mean that I'm lowering demands as we go and making them a little bit more explicit. That might mean that I'm writing down a visual plan just for us, just for my session with him, so he knows what's going to happen. That might mean that I'm really pumping up the incentive and just really getting excited about it for him so he can realize what's coming next is a good, good thing that he's excited about. Throughout the session too, if I'm noticing any kind of sensory needs, we might be stopping to take a break to do like a sensory motor activity, something to get his body back into a calm, alert state so that he can focus on the task ahead of him and accomplish that successfully.
How do you keep track of what you did in a session? Do you write everything down? Do you just have a perfect memory? What do you do?
So I keep electronic documentation of everything. And so while we're working, I always have my laptop open, usually, or an iPad, and I'm just jotting down little quick things. And then after the session, I'll, expand on them or, give a detailed comment about how I think the session went. But that's what's going on. I'll be remarking on, letter A was really difficult today, and there was increased frustration when we started working on it, so that I know for the next session, okay, letter A was really tricky. That's something that I should keep working on.
Okay, perfect. And then would you mind doing the same thing about what your zones of regulation group looks like?
For sure. So in that group, I said there's about 4 to 5 kids, and the kids all have a folder that they take from my sessions to home. And so I'm really using her book. And so I follow along with her like lesson plans pretty for the most part, alongside with what she has planned out. Sometimes we might spend a lot more time on one area, so it might end up being 2 or 3 sessions we're doing for expected behaviors, and then some sessions might be a little quicker. But so everyone comes in, and we kind of like to start with just kind of going around the table and kind of sharing what zone everyone is in, and if there's like a certain reason why they're in that zone. So I might have said, right before break, I said, I'm in the yellow zone because I'm super excited. We're about to have spring break, and I love getting a break. And so that's kind of how we start. And then we go into the lesson of whatever we're talking about. So last week where we were really doing was the expected and unexpected behaviors for school. And we were doing like the social behavior map where we looked at, okay, what behaviors do we do? How do they make other people feel? How are they responding and how they feel? And then how does that make us feel when they respond to us that way? And so it's really beneficial because we get to look at a lot of the things that in real time are happening to these students, and their teachers, and they're with us. And so their resource room teacher, I should say, along with all of their paraprofessionals. And so we're able to get real answers for how, things are, what things annoyed them that week, or what things bothered them, what they did that got them in trouble. And so we're really able to process a lot of those things in more real time, which is really nice. After the group is over, they take their folders home and I email their parents what we talked about so that they can further that learning at home and practice using that same language so that the concepts really get drilled in a little bit better so that the students can utilize them throughout their lives, not just during that zones group.
Oh, that sounds great. In their actual IEPs, do they have this written in under their frequency? I know that there's not a zones goal, but it's
yeah,
group portion written in?
So I don't have it written in. This is my first time doing it with this group. And so it was kind of so a little bit of a trial year. I wanted to see how it went to see if it's something that I think that we want to keep doing with this group or not. I've done it, like I said, I work in an outpatient facility as well. So I've done it with my outpatient kids, but I had never done it in this school setting like this, like so explicitly. I'd done it more, you know, like, oh, like, let me show you some strategies for how to calm your body versus being so explicit about what feelings are and how do we navigate those emotions and how do our feelings make us act in certain ways and how does that impact the way people feel about us. So it's not written in there. We also have social workers in Michigan too. And so the students are getting social work services in addition to my OT services. And so all the kids on that caseload are getting social work as well, where they have a goal that is typically more behavioral or social skill related. So that's happening at the same time as these other things.
Do you think that you'll continue this next year?
I think so. I've gotten really good feedback from the students, from their teachers, as well as the parents. At every IEP meeting we've been at this year, parents have gotten really excited about what they've seen in their students at home. And so I think it's definitely something that I would love to continue. I've gotten good support too from administration about it. And so I think that we might want to try to expand it to other populations as well, just because we've seen the growth and how some peer buddies might benefit from having that language to relate to their peers on the spectrum. So that, you know, if they're seeing someone upset, they might be able to use that zones language to help relate to them a little bit more.
Yeah, I was actually in one school and the entire elementary school was using the zones.
That's awesome.
It just worked out so well because these kids, you know, whether or not they're on an IEP, they benefit from having right. color, that tangible thing to look at to help them identify their feelings.
Right. No, I'm a big, big advocate for just teaching more, taking more opportunities to be more explicit about teaching emotions and teaching, like I said, like how our feelings make us act and how that can make people feel about us. And, you know, it matters how people feel about us. It does, you know, as much as we say maybe it doesn't, even as adults, it matters. It impacts how we feel about ourselves and our self-esteem and our social skills. And so it's important, I think, for us to take every opportunity we can to assume that kids don't know and give them the chance to learn it.
Yeah. Well, you sound like an amazing therapist.
Oh, thank you.
I don't want to take up too much of your time, but can I quickly ask about what your consults with teachers look like?
Yeah, for sure. And so in that kind of setting with the kids on the spectrum, they all have access to that resource room specialist that I told you about that is like certified in autism. That's like their go-to person. So when I'm consulting with that kind of group, it's definitely a little bit different than when I'm consulting with some of my kids who might be on the spectrum that are not in that setting, that are in like a little bit of a different setting with a gen ed elementary that don't have like all the built-in autism supports. And so with that one, I'm really consulting with the paras and with her a little bit more than I am with the gen ed teacher or like the art teacher and that kind of thing. But in my other buildings where I might still have a student on the spectrum, it's a lot of trying to consult with the entire team a little bit more. We don't have like that middle person as we do in this other building. And so it can be a lot more work because there's, you know, you're trying to consult with the social worker, the gen ed teacher, the para, the speech therapist, as well as, you know, all the specialist teachers. And so I try to send out, if I'm on consult for someone, I try to send out an email at least every marking period because I know that everybody's short on time, just to say, you know, like, I'm here again, let me know if you need anything. But in addition to that, I'm just trying to check in with those students at least like once a month to make sure that I'm either observing in, you know, the cafeteria or observing in music, where I know music can be pretty hard for some of our kids because of the sensory needs, to make sure that things are going well. And there's nothing that I feel like I can, you know, advise them on or provide for them to help their school day go a little bit better.
What advice would you have for OTs who are working with the Gen Ed teachers and the teachers are having a hard time understanding their STEMs?
Mm-hmm. So I think, like, I always try to explain to adults that we all have some kind of like self-stimulatory behavior. It's just like kids on the spectrum usually are just not aware of like the social implications of what their self-stims are, right? So I bite my nails, I tap my foot, I totally fidget with things, but like I totally do it in a way that nobody really knows that that's what's happening, right? And because we have that lens, we can see all those stims, right, happening all the time. But adults assume that they are, that's like, you know, like the flapping is the stim. They don't see all the other stims that are happening with all of their students. So I really try to reframe it for them in that way, or I'll try to say, oh, you know, does your husband ever do anything that, like, you know, kind of bothers you, but like they don't even realize they're doing it. So whether it's like, you know, playing with their phone, whether it's, you know, tapping this pencil, those are all stims, right? And the purpose of those stims are to help ourselves either pay more attention or to tune out things that are bothering us. And so if we can just give them that insight, I think that helps a lot in helping them relate to their students a little bit more and see it less as a distraction and more as a, okay, like they're struggling really hard to stay focused right now. How can I show them more empathy? What can I do to help them stay focused? Should I offer them a break? Should I offer them one of the fidgets that we know we have in this room? And also giving them opportunities to talk to their classroom about what it is and what it means. I think that, and you know, in all situations, not just with autism, but we should be a lot more vocal about the things that we do to help ourselves stay focused, right? Or to help ourselves be successful. So I'm all about teaching adults to be more vocal about things that bother them or things that upset them. I think we kind of pretend to kids like, oh, when you're an adult, things don't bother you anymore. But that's not right. That's not true. And all we're teaching them is that they don't have a coping, there's, you know, you don't have a coping skill and you're not going to get one until you become an adult. And so I think it's important for them to see those as opportunities to communicate with their class about what different things are, why people do certain things a certain way, and how we can help them be successful.
That was so perfectly put. I wish I could just like feed that to teachers and just have them listen to exactly what you just said.
Thank you. But it's hard. It's so hard to be a kid, I think. And we just assume, like, I'm a big proponent of, like, don't assume that they know. Like, give them the chance. Give them the benefit of the doubt that they don't. Because if you assume that they know, all you do is frustrate yourself.
Exactly. You're so right. Okay. The last question that I ask everybody is, if you could go talk to your 18-year-old self, would you go into OT again?
I think so. I think so. I totally love what I do. I think that I would want to make sure that I understood, like we were talking about, like all the different financial pieces to it, because it is so expensive. School is really expensive and it's only getting more expensive, it seems like. So I think I would want to maybe just make sure that I was, you know, understanding that part a little bit more. Just loans are a lot to pay back, but I totally love what I do. I love every day waking up and working with my kids. They mean so much to me. You know, my husband laughs because I'll come home with like a different story every day about how something someone said was the coolest thing ever, or, you know, when someone, you know, made a connection today, I was so proud of them. And so like all of the students I work with, they are like my children. Like they mean a ton to me. And so it's super, super rewarding. There are definitely hard days, but like I said, like if you can just be flexible, you can make it.
I relate to everything you just said on a very deep level. I really do like working with the kids, and I love coming home and telling my husband stories. Mm-hmm. But I do just wish that the productivity as mm-hmm. well as the financial piece were talked about more. Because even in schools, you know, what is your general caseload? It sounds like it's pretty busy.
So I travel between a lot of buildings. So I'm in one district, but I travel between, right now I travel between 5 or 6, I think it is. And so my caseload is about like 40 direct and like 20 consults. 25 consults. And so that's, it seems like a good number compared to what I've heard a lot of other people talk about. But you know, I always try to, like, I do a lot extra, like I was talking about, like the zones thing, right? It's not technically on my caseload, but it's time that I'm spending. And so it can be a lot of stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, even if you think about it, that's 60 students that you need to know their information about. Sometimes I find consults are even harder because you don't get the chance to know the student that well.
Right.
So it's harder to consult when you don't know their personality and you can't really play the detective and figure it out because you don't have time to even go see them that frequently.
For sure. For sure. And it's hard because if you don't have a good relationship with a student, chances are they're not going to fill you in on what's going on. And so that's one of the biggest things too, is that rapport is huge. And it's super hard, like you said, to have rapport with someone that you don't see very frequently.
Exactly. So I don't have any answers, but
no, it's hard. It's definitely tricky. But I think being a part of a district where you feel like teachers trust you and teachers value your opinion, and you really can come to them not as like the expert, but just as a team player, I think that helps a lot, because I think teachers then come to me a lot more earlier instead of waiting until, you know, all of a sudden it's the IEP meeting. And I hear, you know, I've had that happen too, where you get to the IEP meeting, the teacher will say, oh, well, this is happening. And you're like, wait, what? Why didn't you tell me about that before? And so when you are able to build really nice relationships with the staff, I think that really makes a difference. It takes more time at the beginning and initially, but as you're able to foster that, I think that helps as well, because then you know about things as they come up more in real time rather than waiting until you're going out of your way to ask about them.
Yes, I think that's really good advice. All right. Well, I appreciate it so much for you coming on here.
Thank you for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it.
All right, guys, that's it for this week. And I loved this episode. I hope that you enjoyed our new format. And the next couple of weeks, we'll be bouncing around between different settings and the different diagnoses. And again, please, please, please consider coming on here. I just love hearing from all you guys. And I've gotten several really nice emails from people just thanking me and thanking you all for coming on here. So I appreciate it. As always, rate and review the podcast and follow me on Instagram as spill_the_OT and email me at spilltheot@gmail.com. All right, bye.